Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Matthew Clamm, whose new book and first novel is Who is Rich? Was just released this month by Random House. Matthew's first book was Sam the Cat and Other Stories. His work's been featured in The New Yorker, Harper's, Esquire, GQ, The Times. He's taught at Johns Hopkins, St. Albans, American and Stockholm University, and numerous workshops. So, who is rich? I don't know whether I can really answer that question, but I'm going to do my best to find out. Rich is a middle-aged, paunchy cartoonist whose annual trek to a writer's and artist's workshop sets the stage for all kinds of raucous, I love that word, raucous, embarrassing and life-changing scenes. Rich's art, his marriage, his affair, his life are stuck in a rut. No, more a downward spiral. The question is, before the book runs its course, is Rich going to be able to extricate himself from all of this? But then the reader eventually asks the question, is that what this is all about? Does he really need to extricate himself? It gives one pause. And it's that pause that makes this book so unforgettable. Do we like Rich? Do we despise him? Do we sympathize with his plight? Or do we just wonder how anyone could get himself in such a mess? In any event, it makes for a wonderful ride, and we leave still reeling from a situation that we're glad we're not in, but happy to have been a part of. So with that, welcome, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So your title asks who the narrator is. Why is that? Shouldn't you and we both know already?
I was casting around for a title for a while, and when I realized that that title could work more than one way, I thought it would be good to title the book with that. And then there was another question, which was question mark or no question mark, and I ended up sort of running through my mind good titles. Who moved my cheese? Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? A couple other titles that had a question mark, and then I decided to put the question mark on there. It makes it more grammatical. But yeah, I mean, you know, this is a story about identity in the way that I think a lot of stories are, and this guy definitely is in that place that a lot of us are familiar with, where he has sort of moved into marriage in its middle phase, parenthood with two small kids, and is feeling that progress maybe is hard. It's hard for him to find progress. There is a little bit of a maze-like quality to these times in our lives. All of us, I think, know that. And he's not sure how to move forward, and he's not sure how to get out of the maze. And he's also considers himself an artist, and yet he hasn't produced anything in more than 5 years. So if he isn't making art, what is he? And he's struggling with all those questions. So that's sort of one side of that title, Who is Rich? And then the other side of the title has to do with the fact that the woman who he's having this experience with over the 4 days that the book takes place is the wife of a Wall Street billionaire and is herself really satisfyingly miserable. And by that I mean, I think we all wonder what it would be like to have a lot of money. And I think she helps anyone who's wondered that get a sense of how it doesn't make your dreams come true or whatever. So then that idea of, you know, who really is well off, that question maybe is bigger than the money, the number of dollars a person has.
It's funny that all the reviews and everybody, the first question they say is, you know, is how did you get the background so right for both the magazine that Rich works for, and then they say what magazine it thinly veils, and the setting of the workshop long weekend. And talk a little bit about that, how, you know, your experience and then the reviews cattily say that you'll never be invited back again and all that.
Right, yeah. I'm actually going up there this week to one of those conferences.
I saw that on your website.
They'll probably
that'll be hilarious.
With torches and pitchforks. No, I think What was the question?
The question was, you know, the background, you know, what experience do you have with these workshops and the type of Hamptons kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, so I've been attending
Pennington
first as a student and then as a teacher at these conferences for you know, 20 years or more, and have just been fascinated by the setting because it seems to me to be a kind of ideal place where to set a piece of fiction, because the people who go to these things, they just set aside their you know, carefully constructed normal personality, their persona, the thing they use to negotiate work and their neighbors and their marriage and their all that conventional stuff, and then they indulge in this one obsession. The teachers, I think, really do it also. You're away from your personal life, really, and instead you're sort of, it's like you're cast back into a sort of adolescent, in the way that an adolescent can just stomp up to his or her bedroom, slam the door, and play the guitar. That's the kind of mindset a lot of people are at when they're at these things, and it's really interesting that there is this other self, and that other self has appetites and goals and ambitions and dreams, and it kind of comes out for a few days in a setting like this. I was fascinated by that for years, and then I thought that it would be really cool to set a story there. And so when I started working on it, I was just sort of hoping that characters would do interesting things. And there was another thing you asked me, how I got right. Oh, the magazine. You know, as somebody who's written for a bunch of magazines, I mean, you know this when you're inside the magazine world, that people inside the magazine world are pretty fascinated with the magazine world. I mean, the magazine world is in a transition now, and I love magazines, and I love holding them in my hands. I think they're shiny and beautiful, and I love the photography, and I miss the fact that they are moving online and kind of losing some of that power. But, to watch what was going on over the last 10 years at various magazines, some that I was connected to and others, you know, namely the New Republic, watching what happened there, it was just you know, having a ringside seat at a horrible massacre of a boxing match or something. I mean, it was just so wonderful and awful to watch, for instance, what went on at the New Republic.
Yeah.
And I used it, some of it.
Yeah, it's funny too. Like I was going to talk about a little bit about the cartoons that are in the book, because mm-hmm. they act as their epigraphs. And talk a little bit about how you, in between chapters, you know, you have these cartoons that are really wonderfully drawn. I've forgotten the gentleman's name.
His name is John Cuneo, Cuneo. He's a wonderful artist who's done covers for The New Yorker. Used to do an advice column for Esquire regularly, but he's done stuff for every magazine, and he's, you know, widely respected and adored, and he can draw so amazingly. I had cut out pictures from a couple different magazines, including The New Yorker and Esquire, and I had them on my desk for maybe 5 years, because I always thought that there would be a drawing component in the book, because the narrator is a cartoonist and an illustrator, and I just didn't really know how. I knew I needed to finish the book before I dealt with that question, and then, of course, it took too long, and I didn't have all that much time, and suddenly I was in a sort of frenzy last fall to find the right person. I thought it would be John. It turned out we did work it out, and then we started exchanging these emails, and they went on for a couple of months, and there's probably 100 long emails in there. And what was so amazing was that he's brilliant, and if I would sort of get an idea for the first drawing, and then I'd try to get an idea for the next drawing. I'd try to find a sort of space them through the book, and to see his attempt to read between the lines of what I wanted while he was reading the book was so interesting. Every once in a while he would send me a sort of page with his doodles on it of things he was trying to do with different faces, trying to figure out what was okay for me. He was very concerned that he not reveal faces of characters unless I sort of demanded it.
Right.
Because he wanted the reader to have their formulate their own image of what these people look like. And in the end, I thought there's so much soul in his line work that I didn't feel like it was taking away from my ability to create images in the reader's mind. Although, I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I turned a page and I saw the toad, you know? I mean,
yeah.
There he is on the left. I mean, it's like obvious. So, I mean,
right.
I thought, what did he do? Did he read the chapters and did he read the chapters and then draw? Did you tell him what you want the toad to look like? Because it was like exactly, you know, it doesn't often happen. You have a picture in your mind of what the character looks like. It's probably not what the author has in his mind. But in this case, I think it was pretty darn close.
I mean, I thought so too. I just thought, you know, it's the difference. It's when you're working with somebody who's like a genius, they just can do cool stuff like that. So yeah, I'd highlight stuff in the book. And then I'd talk about why I thought this person might look a certain way. And sometimes it was more nailed down and other times less. But yeah, John's so intuitive.
It's so funny because you can almost tell he's from Tennessee by the picture. I don't know. He's got all this stuff going on in it. I wouldn't know necessarily what he collected, but I would know he collected something.
Right.
You know, it's funny. In the book, Amy is such a beautiful and complex character, and so is Robin, for that matter. And they both have such great backstories, and they do such good work, interesting work. What the hell do they see in Rich?
You know, that's the funniest thing. I was just reading. I know that Elena Ferrante is really famous for the four novels, the tetralogy of My Brilliant Friend, but she's written these other novels that come before them. One of them is called Days of Abandonment, and it starts with a husband leaving a wife. All you know about the husband is bad. Everything you know about him is bad, and yet she says, right up until the time he announced his leaving, that they had this marriage, which she describes, where they would say they loved each other, they would kiss and hug often, they had two children who they were raising together, and she said, and sometimes he would make me laugh so hard that I would, that tears would pour down my face, and I was so surprised by that. And then it reminded me of something which really doesn't appear very much in my book, but there's one or two lines where the narrator says, it was good between us, or it was good between us more than half, or at least half the time. And I think there's that thing that people know who are in long relationships, which is that people choose to stay in long relationships for a reason, which is that, you know, the deep, dark secret is that sometimes it's really good. And sometimes it's really just great to have somebody who you know isn't going to leave and will stick by you and shares all these different aspects of your life. And all I can say is, he must be fairly entertaining to be around, because what we know about him is so problematic. So what do they see in him? I'm not sure. I think for Amy, it's more straightforward because their relationship is simpler. He has been listening to her and sharing this life that has been so overwhelming to her. She's, you know, the wife of a billionaire who's got a sort of complicated relationship with her husband. It's really unpleasant in a lot of ways. She doesn't have anybody to tell that to, but she finds him and he listens and obviously really tunes into that. And I think, so in a very basic way, he is doing what any of us need, which is listening and paying attention. That right there is a friend. And I think for Robin and the narrator, Rich, you know, there is a partnership. You see it in evidence in the last scene where they talk, I think, more than any other place. But also, I think people who've had small kids that don't sleep in the beginning, they know that to have a baby who's a year old and isn't sleeping and a four-year-old who is only now getting the hang of sleeping, it drives everybody a little insane. And I think if you've been through it, you sort of can understand and maybe sort of calibrate the quality of their relationship, compare it to what it would be without that sleeplessness, and maybe realize that there's enough there to hold them together. I don't know.
Well, that's like one of the things you do really well in this book is, and we were talking a little bit before about marriage and infidelity, but you make marriage like Homer Price's donut factory. It's like it's like a machine that you got to tend to. It's like this machine in between two people that you got to keep feeding the batter in, and you got to make sure you don't put somebody's diamond ring in there by mistake. Which but you do a good job of creating it as a machine. I mean, don't you kind of do that? You make it a machine for Robin and Rich. It is like a machine. It's their thing they tend to.
I mean, they're in a particular phase in marriage where with two little kids, there is so much sort of this kind of like, routine sort of painful toil, you know, that goes into it. Just the kinds of things you need to do to get through a day when you have two little kids, I think, make the marriage look a little bit like a kind of army of two that's fighting a battle, you know, with their backs pressed against each other or whatever. And it's not sexy, and it's not that fun. But, you know, I mean, I think, who was it? I'm trying to remember the title of this book. All Joy and No Fun, is that what it is? Judith Warner? It's a book about raising little kids.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think so.
there is this incredibly sweet and beautiful thing that goes on when you're raising little kids. That's just you want to go back there so badly for a day, but you sure don't want to go back there and redo the whole thing just because it's so physically and emotionally demanding. It's something. I mean, I have to say this. I was talking about this with a friend. She was the second oldest of eight kids, and she said, I never went anywhere without a little brother or sister, usually multiple ones throughout my junior high and high school. I always had one of my siblings around. I thought I knew what it would be like to have kids, and I had no idea. I had no idea that it would take up this much of my heart and my body and my mind and my attention and my love. She's like, even though I had taken care of kids all my life, and I think she says it best, it's just really surprising how demanding it is. And I think it just changes the marriage. It makes the marriage into this thing, which is this sort of a machine that you're talking about.
It was, I think it was Louis C.K. I saw on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, and he was talking about taking his kid to preschool or something and having to wake up at 6:30 or 6 o'clock to feed him and everything, and driving to preschool and waiting in the car line and all this stuff. And he was going, I can't stand it. It's horrible, horrible, horrible. He goes, but I know that someday I'm going to look back on this and I'm going to miss it.
Yeah.
And I feel that way about my kids. I can remember doing all that stuff and thinking and whining and complaining the whole time. And then now thinking back on it and going, you know, wow, I really enjoyed doing that.
How old are your kids now?
Oh, I got kids like out the wazoo. I got a 37-year-old, a 34-year-old, a 19-year-old, and a 16-year-old, and four grandchildren. Wow. How old are your kids?
I have one daughter, and she's 12.
So when you were writing this book, since it's taken a while, why did it take so long anyway? Why did it take 17 years?
I started it in January of 2010, and I was doing things before that, including writing a book's worth of magazine journalism. But I started in 2010. She was 4.5 years old.
Oh, so she was the same age as
the older girl, as Kaya. Yeah.
Yeah, Kaya.
And she had just really started, like she had just figured out how to sleep at about age four. So that was still pretty fresh in my mind.
Oh, yeah, the accident that Kaya has, too, the description of that is so familiar to any parent. I mean, someone who reads it who doesn't have kids isn't going to feel the same way as somebody who's got a kid who's been on a body board while they're putting 14 stitches in them. Yeah. That's a feeling.
I can only imagine what things. Do you have any boys among your four kids?
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I mean, girls, I think, are a little more, or some.
I don't know, no, because now with girls, you have the trampoline, and then you have those foam balls that are in the trampoline pit, and there's always a kid in the trampoline pit in the balls when the other kid jumps off, and then they always hit their chin on the kid's forehead, And then they always get 6 stitches, but you can't see them because it's right at the edge of the chin and the jaw.
Yeah,
that's so true. 3 times I've done that one.
Oh, my God.
You know what else is really funny? When you wrote it, because you stick Mitt Romney and that election cycle in it, and I kept thinking, what if you wrote it now? What if you had written it during the last election cycle? How would you have ever
there was a moment, you know, I mean, there were plenty of moments where I thought, I don't have to worry about this because, you know, as it, I wanted to set it during a presidential campaign year, and the 2012 just sort of seemed to be the right one, timing-wise for me writing the book, starting in 2010. But then as we moved closer to 2016, I remember thinking, well, it's going to be okay because Hillary is going to win, and it's not going to be an issue that I chose someone who's so much less explosive of character than Trump. And it turned out I was wrong, of course. But, you know, I guess at a certain point you just have to sort of say, like, whatever it is, it's going to be some little record of history, because if it had been Trump, then 5 years from now, you know, people would feel that that was dated. But, I mean, and I think it also is good to remember that some of the most outrageous things that Trump has suggested, I mean, at least from my lefty progressive mind, Romney, he wanted to, you know, he had it on his campaign page to wipe out Roe versus Wade. He politely asked 11 million illegal immigrants to self-deport. You know, he was interested in deregulation and in wiping out healthcare as we know it or whatever. It's not totally different, but
it's just that now, you know, in my mind, George W. Bush is the greatest statesman of all time.
I know.
You know, I used to rant and rave on Facebook, and then I stopped doing that when this happened because I realized, you idiot, you were ranting and raving over this. Look at what we're talking about now. It's so funny when I talk to authors now about it because everybody feels exactly the same way. In fact, I was talking to, I forgot who I was talking to, one author the day after the election, and he wanted to postpone the interview because he was so depressed that he couldn't talk. And I posited to one author that the reason why all authors feel the same about what's going on now is because they're all intelligent. But he thought that was me being very elitist.
But I do think that it's a funny problem because I would like to see someone, and I'm sure they're working on it right now and they'll come along soon enough, who's able to do something with fiction that's better than the surreal quality that Donald Trump brings to our lives.
But it's so hard to do because it's so hard to satirize something that's already satirical. And that's what happens with reality TV. I mean, I'm reading about Black China and Rob Kardashian, and why do I even know those names? You know, why are they in my head? Don't I need those brain cells?
I mean, look how long it took for us to get art made about Nixon. It took a long time, you know?
That's true.
It might just take a little time for people to have enough distance to make sense of Donald Trump.
We should go back to the books so you can sell books.
Okay.
Okay. So what I was going to ask you was, you know, Rich is, first I thought, okay, I'll just read this the way it is, and everything that happens really happens exactly the way Rich says it does. And then I thought, well, the book's titled Who is Rich? And if he doesn't know, and if the author doesn't know, maybe Rich is just like the most unreliable narrator ever. And I know this has arisen in some of the reviews as well. But, you know, so maybe certain things, which I won't give away, like certain things that are in a cup or certain things that are you wear on your wrist, maybe it didn't happen. Maybe he wasn't standing by the beach, and maybe he didn't fling something, you know? And I started thinking about, well, maybe this, is it all in his head? Am I just riding this ride that he's creating? So then I don't expect you to tell me whether it's right or wrong, because it can't be. But you know what I mean? You start feeling that way.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody the other day, and we were talking about The Things They Carried, which a lot of people are familiar with that novel. And of course, it's on a much, you know, greater scale and in a much more noble cause. But I think Tim O'Brien there is trying to say, here's the feeling of me. I'm trying to give you, the reader, the feeling of being with me right now while I'm trying to write this book. It's alive to me right now, and I'm struggling with the truth versus the facts and my gut feeling about what is truer than the facts that about a war story. He does that so beautifully. And I think in my own small way, I was trying to bring the reader in and say, look, dude, I'm trying to make a story out of this, and I have some struggles, and I'm bringing you in to help to with me, so you'll feel a little bit of what it's like to be the person struggling to take what is, you know, some parts of a person's life and make them into a story. And I hoped also that it would remind the reader that what they're reading is, of course, a made thing, and it's the result of a bunch of choices to hopefully keep the reader riveted to the book from the first sentence on. But I'm busy winking out of one eye, winking to the reader, saying, come along with me. I know you know this is made up. I know you know this is based in part on my real life, but I also know you know that this is fiction, and I want you to kind of come along on this crazy train with me. I think I was just trying to get all that stuff in the book.
What's really funny is that, you know, it's like, I was thinking, you know, why can't Rich draw anymore? He's drawing all the time. He has lots of narrative and exposition. He just doesn't have a story. And then I realize it's because you're telling us the only stories he has are the stories he robs from the people he loves the most and then co-ops. And, you know, and I thought, you know, that's interesting. Is he ever going to be able to do it again? And that's one of the major questions of the book. And you leave it where what he's doing is he's creating this novel, if you will, about something that he really shouldn't be telling other people. That's where you kind of leave it. And I'm thinking, I wonder if that's what he's going to do. Because everything he does is kind of implosionary, if that's a word.
Yeah, I mean, he sort of says to himself, and he says to you, if in the first few pages of the book, you know, basically, I call myself an artist, I call myself a cartoonist, but I'm not writing about my life anymore. I'm not making comics about my life anymore. So who am I? And then there's this pressure, which is, I've got to produce a piece of art. And I think what I'm trying to let the reader know is, by the end of the book, he should have enough material to create a piece of art. He's brought us along and let us see this story as it unfolds. And then you sort of have to think, well, is he going to be able to make that into a graphic novel? Like, he has the material to do it now, and he ought to be able to. But I think I'm also trying to tell the reader that there's some personal sacrifice that goes with taking some material from your own life and using it, you know, to make art. It is a sacrifice. I'm not necessarily saying to people who read my book, you should feel sorry for me because I put my life in a blender and I exposed myself and loved ones to the readers. But I think want readers to know that it's there's a personal commitment that's involved. And there is a sort of demand, that the artwork makes. And it sort of says, you know, I'm not your mistress, I'm your wife. You have to be committed to the artwork fully and completely, maybe before anything else, if you want to get that thing out into the world.
Yeah, that brings me to Salito, because what you were just talking about, the things they carried, Salito is telling that story, isn't he? The other cartoonist who's rising star. There's another cartoonist in the book who's really done really, really well, and Rich has to introduce him one night. But it turns out that a lot of what he says is conflated, the new word conflated, with other people's lives and events, right?
Yeah, I mean, so this is a character who's 15 years younger than the narrator. He's the hot young cartoonist who's, you know, profiles in the New York Times and whose book is on all these lists and who is suddenly kind of like exploded onto the scene. And you find out that he's a guy who as a child walked from Guatemala to the United States alone, pretty much, to find his parents. And he's just one of, you know, it's a real story that is happening every day He has this amazing larger than life story, and he's turned it into something to create a graphic novel. But then he also does write. He speaks to the fact that there are parts of it that he had to manipulate in order to make a better story. And manipulate is one way to put it, but another way to put it is that he changed some of the facts. And what do we call it? Is it a memoir? Is it a novel? Is it a graphic novel? Is it a piece of nonfiction? Is it a piece of fiction? All of these questions are posited by various characters in the last sort of third of the book. And I mean, I'm glad you picked up on it. I am really interested in that. I think that, you know, as much as we would love to think that there are certain kinds of writing that are utterly and entirely fact-based, I mean, look at our country right now. We have half of this country that thinks the other half is out of their minds for what they believe when they read it in the newspaper, see it in the news. When a front page New York Times or Wall Street Journal journalist writes a story, as soon as they set down that first sentence, they're making choices about what they include and what they leave out, and that shapes a story. And it's not, you know, pure advocacy journalism, but by some people's perspective, it is. And I just wanted to introduce those questions too, you know, that struggle to, you know, there is no such thing as a reliable narrator, and there is no such thing as the facts. You know, when you're telling a story, an involved, a complicated story full of emotion and psychological and intellectual, spiritual, whatever, emotional detail, there is a distorted perception through which that story is seen and told. And those distortions and perceptions make the story interesting, but they also make it one person's version. And any of us, you know, who, when we get together at Thanksgiving and we start telling stories about things that happened in our childhood with our siblings or other family members or whatever, people have entirely different perspectives on just simply what happened. Just the basic facts, even.
Oh, yeah, trust me, I know. But what's interesting about Salito's speech and his slideshow is that he comes right out and says what's that guy in his name, Fry, A Million Little Pieces, what he didn't say. And, you know, which got, and I always thought he got kind of a bad rap because I thought, okay, yeah, he made it up, so what? Big deal.
Yeah.
You know?
I know. I know. I mean, I feel the same way. I don't know if you've ever heard him, but there's this guy his name is Mike Daisy, and he was on This American Life, and he is a brilliant monologuist who had one episode of This American Life that was like the most popular one ever. And it turns out that he completely fabricated a couple of details in an amazing story. He just exaggerated a couple of facts, but his story was about a factory in China that builds the iPhone, and he said that there were armed guards where there weren't. There were some other things that he misrepresented or whatever. I just felt like he's been shamed out of society. You know, he's still working as a monologuist, but his career isn't the same. And I do think that it's a kind of interesting gotcha.
Well, yeah, especially shame. Now that you have a president who sends out tweets every day. That each one of them contains more, you know, fabrications in them, you know, it was funny talking about the iPhone factory. That brings up the part of the book where Rich is doing the drawing of the Chinese workers. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? That was interesting.
Well, this is actually stuff I learned listening to Mike Daisy. This is so the narrator is a magazine illustrator, and he's working for a magazine of politics and culture, and there's a story about where electronics come from, and he is tasked with illustrating a story about life in a Chinese factory where 400,000 people are employed, where there are 25 cafeterias that are running 24 hours a day, where there are a spate of suicides, which I think happened in 2010 or somewhere around then in the Foxconn factory in China. And the average age of the suicide is like 18. And the average amount of hours per week a person works is just outrageous. And it's just, there's a lightness to the book. There's a lot of silliness and sort of tomfoolery, but there's also this undercurrent, which is that this guy is part of, you know, he's illustrating these stories that are part of our time. You know, there's stuff about war, and there's things about just these deadly serious issues that, as a cartoonist, he's forced to kind of take and try to make art out of. And he sort of says to the theater at one point, like, try making a picture of that. And so anyway, it's just something to think about. And I think it's something, anytime you open a magazine and you see that there's sensitively drawn artwork, you have to imagine that someone really took that story in and then tried to make art out of it to help add to this important story.
Do you know a lot about art? Because Rich gives good advice when he does his workshops, or did you just learn that as you wrote?
Yeah, I mean, some of it I picked up from reading books that are interview cartoonists and other artists, and some of it was just from the kind of thing that goes on in a writing class that I have taught many times too, and I kind of just try to, you know, translate it, transpose the advice giving or whatever to drawing instead. I took a few drawing classes, and I once took a cartooning class up in Vermont at the Center of Cartoon Studies for a few days, and I really was interested in how they talk to their students too.
Yeah, I know. I like the way you go. Stairs are hard, you know? good work.
Yeah.
Stairs are hard.
Right, they are. They are. There's a lot of different dimensions coming at you at once that you've got to get right.
Yeah, it's funny because Rich decides that day he's going to be kind of nice to people, but overall, and this has been mentioned in the reviews too, I mean, he's pretty mean-spirited towards everybody else. And I guess what you said in one of them was, you know, it's because this is the way he feels about himself, he projects it out to the world.
Yeah.
But, overall, he doesn't have a particularly good view of almost anybody, except maybe Robin. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, he has kind of caustic opinions of people, it's true, but I think it's also fair to say that he has, like, sort of strong feelings about everyone and everything. He has strong feelings about
his children.
About his children and about, you know, his passion for, you know, Amy. He has this intense, you know, he falls madly in love with her for 3 days. He's crazy about the place he's in. He loves the sky at the beach in the summer. He loves the ocean. He loves the bay. He loves the smell as he walks down the street in this busy sort of touristy, you know, former fishing village of, like, you smell beer, you smell ketchup, you smell French fries, you smell taffy. You know, he has all of these kind of powerful feelings and sensations that overwhelm him. And I think, and one of the things is that he's hypercritical of himself and his own failings, and he's critical of other people too. And that comes out.
Well, just the fact that we've been going on for 40 minutes about all these little things will show a potential reader that this is a great book to pick up. Oh, by the way, I own an independent bookstore, and the book is already out there now today. I guess today's the day.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Yeah, July 11th, today. Today is the day we can put it out. So it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. This is great. It's great to talk to you.
Okay, Matt. See you later.
Okay, take care.
You Bye-bye. Too. Bye-bye. That was Matthew Clam. He was talking to us about his book, Who is Rich?, which is really funny, really good. I really enjoyed it. It's a successor to his short story collection, Sam the Cat, which he wrote almost 17 years ago, and we've been waiting all this time for his first novel, which is really, really good. And it's out, it just came out, and we have it on the front shelves of the bookstore, so I strongly urge you to come by and pick it up. We have Mrs. Kelly coming to discuss her book, Jane Austen, The Secret Radical, a book about Jane Austen that tries to open up her life to us because there's so little known about it. It's like trying to tell you what happened to Jesus from when he was 4 years old till the crucifixion, or what the life of William Shakespeare or Thomas Pynchon is like. But anyway, she tries to use Jane Austen's books to give us an idea of what kind of radical she was, what kind of person she was. And then we have another one, Alex Gilvary, who's a friend of mine, and who wrote Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant, and who now has a new book called Eastman Was Here. And it promises to be a big hit this summer. And award-winning poet and memoirist Jill Bielaski will stop by to discuss her new memoir, Poetry Will Save Your Life. So we have a lot of things coming up, and hopefully you'll join us for those things. In any event, thanks as always for being here, and we look forward to having you back with our next author on The Avid Reader.